Hey, Alliance Towers and Shields listeners, it's Shelley. A little programming note before we get started. In this episode, we talk about the Canopy service available through libraries and universities, and we talk about specific films that are showing now on Canopy. Well, it seems that that's not the case, because not every Canopy user has access to the same movies at the same time. You may not be able to watch movies we talk about right away, but you will be able to see them in Canopy at some point if you have a subscription. Just wanting to let you know that we know that. And in the show notes where Canopy links are mentioned, I have included IMDb links instead, because there's not a live Canopy link when the movie isn't available in your area. Second of all, we were planning to talk about Treasure of the Sierra Madre on this episode, but the world changed a lot, and we thought instead we would do something a little different. So if you're missing Treasure of the Sierra Madre, please enjoy a little snippet from the trailer before we get started. Thanks. It's Lions, Towers, and Shields, Episode 4. I'm your host, Shelley Brisbane, and we have a little bit of a format break today because the world is broken format. But I have some great panelists with me. We're going to talk to you about what movies you might want to watch right now during the pandemic, because of it, in spite of it. But we're going to stick to classic movies, despite some people's complaints about my rules, which we'll get to in a minute. But first, I want to introduce you to our wonderful panelists. Hello, Jean McDonald. How are you?
Oh, hi, Shelley. I am doing great. I'm very excited for this draft. Does this mean I'm number one in the order? Please, please, please.
No, it just means that I heard you laugh, so I thought I would pick on you
that
first.
That means I'm not number one then, I guess. I don't know. Whatever.
No, if you look in the link, the numbers have already been chosen. We'll get to that shortly as well. And Philip Michaels. Hi, Phil. How are you?
Hi, number one in your order, number one in your hearts. That's me.
That's right. And making another return appearance, it's Mr. Nathan Alderman. Hello.
Hi. Greetings from my underground bunker where I sit on a throne of hoarded toilet paper.
Can we come over?
No. There's a time lock.
And last but not least, Erica Ensign, how are you?
I am so happy to finally be able to be here. That's how I am.
I'm really glad all of you guys are here, because I've chatted with you on and off about, some of you have been on the show, some of you haven't, but it's great to get the band together, so to speak. So here's how this is going to work. We are going to draft, incomparable to trademark, we're going to draft movies from the classic era, by which I mean 1930 to 1960. If we deviate a little bit, that is not a rule I'm super fastidious about, but it was a starting place. Secondly, movies that you might want to watch in this time of trouble, those could be movies that remind you of or make you go far, far away in your thoughts from the time of trouble. And third, they cannot be a movie in the three episodes of this show that we've done so far that has already appeared on Lions, Towers, and Shields. So is everybody good with the rules?
Works for
well,
me.
Well, I'll have to throw out, I was going to select the movie where it's the tree coming at the camera, but I'll have to throw that out. So
depending on how many of my picks get sniped, I might get daring and go all the way to 1962, but we'll see.
Oh my God. Perish the thought. So random.org was our friend once again today, and I have chosen an order in which we will be drafting movies. We will do three rounds. We have a little time left. We might do some bonus picking, but there will be at least three rounds. And let's start with Phil.
Yes, well, we've actually been in our household doing the We're All Never Going to Leave the House Again Film Festival. And when I do that, I want big, fluffy, pointless musicals. And no era of musical was bigger and fluffier and more pointless than the 1930s, where you have a buffet of broad movie choices. And I think I'm going to pick one that we actually have watched. It's Footlight Parade, which is the 1933, directed by Lloyd Bacon. It is a descent into madness starring Jimmy Cagney and Joan Blondell. Jimmy Cagney plays a man who produces what are called prologues. These are the shows that appear before in between movies to keep the audience entertained. I guess this was actually a thing, though I'm not sure they were as elaborate as they are here, because our good friend Busby Berkeley is doing the directing of the musical sequences. some of the things in the movies are problematic, as the youngsters might say. When Jimmy Cagney proposes a song and dance number on the slaves of Africa, I think you're canceled, Jimmy Cagney. But they don't actually do that one. There are some other ones that are of varying quality, but it's just a delightful example of your pre-code musicals with Ruby Keeler and Dick Powell and all the sorts of people that you see in those great 1930s musicals. All the songs appear at the end so that they can get the plot out of the way. It's an enjoyable film.
So all of the usual Warner Brothers players except Busby Berkeley.
Yes. Well, no, he does do the he doesn't appear on camera, but he did stage the musical sequences.
Oh, he choreographed. Okay, so Lloyd Bacon directed, but Berkeley was actually doing the musical. All right, awesome. So it fits in the canon of Berkeley films. Great. Mm-hmm. All right. I believe I've seen it. It's been some time. It is the point at which they hadn't figured out, well, Jimmy Cagney was still doing mostly gangster pictures, but it was like, oh yeah, that guy can dance. Let's put him in this movie with all the musical stars.
And he even gets a musical number at the end.
Man, I haven't seen it in ages, but I remember enjoying it very much.
It's fun. Jean, what is your pick?
One movie that we used to watch once a year when I was a kid came on television once a year, and it seemed like just completely permeated our notion of what movies were about and what stories were like, is Wizard of Oz, 1939. And I picked it because... it made such an impression on me as a kid, and I enjoyed seeing it every year, although truthfully, I was a little bit scared by and would be a little bit nerve-wracked. But I think children today would not find it especially scary. I don't know, but I don't have kids, so I don't really know. Haven't tried to show them Wizard of Oz, but I would say that it's escapist film in the best sense of the word. We go somewhere totally different and we face a totally different kind of challenge that we can eventually solve at the end and learn something about ourselves. And I would watch it again, and I'm planning to.
Wow, I cannot believe that this was not on my list. And I think the only reason it was not on my list is because I don't actually think of The Wizard of Oz as like an old movie, because it's so timeless. Yeah. It just feels constantly current, because, yeah, we would also watch it every year that when they showed it on, you know, whatever channel, and we would make popcorn and it was a big deal. So it just seems like a movie that's always been there. So I would like to retroactively add this to my list and say, gosh darn, I was sniped.
Surely the one that most of us have seen.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. My daughter saw it when she was 7. She wasn't particularly scared by it. Not even the parts that are kind of scary. She was terrified by The Wiz.
That's understandable.
Especially the subway scene in The Wiz, where the pillars come to life and try and eat Dorothy. So go with The Wizard of Oz. Don't pick The Wiz.
Good advice. No. Erica, what's your first pick?
All right. I am starting with my favorite of all of the bunch. It is actually one of my favorite movies of all time, not just my favorite classic film. And it is also, you know, for this time, it is one of my very first go-tos when I need some escapist, joyful, fairy tale-esque, romantic comfort. Like, this movie might as well have been designed specifically for me and the things that make me the happiest. And that is Midnight from 1939, starring Claudette Colbert, Don Ameche, Frances Lederer, Mary Astor, and John freaking Barrymore. It has this amazing cast. And it is, to my mind, like, just by far my favorite romantic comedy of the era. And I will state for the record that I hate slapstick and I only tolerate screwball. So that sort of gives you an idea of where I'm coming from and where this movie hits me in the happy place, because it has really no slapstick to speak of. And the screwball is definitely less screwy than a lot of movies from this era. So if that sounds like it's your wheelhouse, please join me, because it's my wheelhouse too. As you might have guessed from the title, it is a Cinderella story, which also firmly presses my buttons as a viewer. So if you're a fairy tale fan, you will be very comfortable in this wheelhouse with us. You have Claudette Colbert playing Eve Peabody. She's a showgirl who just lost all her cash in Monte Carlo, and all she owns is the glamorous evening gown on her back. So she hops into the back of a cab on a rainy Paris night and who should be the driver, but one Tibor Cherny, played by Don Ameche in, I think, his most hunky role ever. And there's instant chemistry, because how can there not be between those two people? He agrees to drive her to all the nightclubs in town in hopes that she can get a job singing, and then when she's hired, she'll pay his fare and then some. But alas, after a long night of driving, she doesn't have any luck, and he invites her to stay at his place for the night. While he's out driving, so it's, you know, totally cool. And that exchange, like, in the cab is one of my favorite in the whole film. And that's, like, the movie has barely even gotten to the action yet, and it's just already really snapping. But she decides it's a dangerous idea, so she hops out of the cab while he's filling up with gas and runs off, sneaks into a high society party using a pawn ticket instead of an invitation. She claims to be the Baroness Cherny. She steals the cabbie's last name. She gets invited to a card game. She catches the eye of a French gentleman. That causes some consternation from one of the other ladies in the game. Then a mysterious benefactor loads her purse up with cash so she can stay in the game. And the Cinderella theme then just continues. She suddenly has a fancy hotel suite to return to. And a crate load of fancy clothes are delivered the next morning, which is another one of my favorite scenes, is her waking up and discovering that, and her very skeptical reaction to meeting her fairy godfather. She's just so outstanding in this movie. It makes my teeth hurt. And meanwhile, of course, Don Ameche is rallying all the cabs of London to find her as she falls deeper and deeper into her false identity in high society. And yet there's literally a ball. There are jokes about midnight striking. There's some nice backbiting high society digs. And because it's a rom-com, it has a happy ending, even though it's a divorce. But trust me, it's a good happy ending. It is just a delightful film that makes me happy every time I watch it.
I just love the way she says Tibor. I don't know why, but for some reason, right? Just that
Tibor!
Which is a great name besides.
It is. Mm-hmm.
I think that's on Blu-ray if you're a disc-focused person.
Yeah,
and I know that because my husband is a huge Claudette Colbert fan, and I got him some Colbert movies for Christmas. So
I have it on DVD myself. I need to upgrade if it is, in fact, on Blu-ray. Yeah, sadly, it's not streaming anywhere that I could find yet.
Well, that's something I should point out, that all these movies, if they are streaming, I will have streaming links, or if they're available for purchase on disc, I will do that research for you. You'll be able to find it somewhere. Trust us. Nathan, what's your pick?
So my first pick, and hopefully if none of you snipe me, all of my picks are available for streaming on Canopy, which is the streaming service you can get with a library card if you're lucky. So you might want to check into that. It's a great service. It has a ton of great movies, and it seems like they've added a bunch just recently. Can't imagine why they would have wanted to add a bunch of movies to their streaming service at this particular moment in time, but hey, it works out well for everybody. So we're going back to 1940 to one of the first American movies by an obscure British filmmaker known as Alfred Hitchcock. It's Foreign Correspondent, one of my favorite obscure Hitchcock films. It never really comes up in the annals of the great Hitchcock films, but it is a blast from start to finish. I like to think of it as Alfred Hitchcock's Michael Bay film, because it is one of the most ridiculously action-packed films he ever made. And yeah, I'm including North by Northwest in that. So Joel McRae is a scrappy crime reporter from America sent to Europe on the brink of World War II to try and cover these peace talks that could decide whether the continent plunges into war or not. And while he's there, he meets equally scrappy peace activist Lorraine Day, who is awesome. She gives off strong Princess Leia vibes in this movie. I've got the poster for Foreign Correspondent, and it says grossly inaccurately, he wanted his story, she wanted love, which is, if it had been accurate, it would be, he wanted to get a date with her, she wanted to prevent an entire continent from falling into a devastating war, and he was bothering her about it. But it is a totally fun movie, incredible set pieces from start to finish. There's one suspense piece where McRae is creeping around trying to evade some bad guys inside a windmill that will have you on the edge of your seat. There's a scene that turns, it kind of shows how you would weaponize the stateroom scene in A Night at the Opera if you needed to escape from some bad people. That is very funny and very clever. There's an assassination in the rain with a sea of umbrellas. There's a plane crash sequence at the end that will have your jaw dropping even to this day. And best of all, there's George Sanders. George Sanders shows up. See, in my headcanon, ostensibly in the movie, George Sanders is a fellow reporter, a British reporter. But in my headcanon, he is actually a spy for British intelligence working undercover because he's just too cool to be anything else. His name is Scott Foliot. He drives a sports car with his nameplate on it. He, you know, he's impossibly dashing, suave, and sangfroid at every turn. At one point, he jumps out a window to escape some bad guys and lands in an awning and brushes it off like it was nothing. And before he jets off to catch a Nazi spy, he informs a friend of his to cancel his rumba lessons. He is spectacularly awesome and the superhero of this movie. And I can't get away from this movie without mentioning one last delight, which is Edmund Gwenn. You may remember him as Santa Claus from Miracle on 34th Street. And in this, in an incredible sequence, he plays Mr. Rolly, the most lovable, twinkly-eyed homicidal murderer you ever did meet. And there's a great sequence where he is Joel McRae's lovable, sweet, twinkly-eyed tour guide through London, except he is always constantly trying to kill Joel McRae and failing for various reasons. It's suspenseful, it's funny, it's action-packed, and best of all, this is from the early period of Hitchcock, where women were actual characters in his movies instead of being attractively dressed props that he could work out his fixations on. So Lorraine Day's character is a proactive heroine. She's tough, she's smart, she's awesome. The movie has morally ambiguous villains. Like I said, a final plane crash sequence you've got to see to believe, and it is just a terrific thriller that ends on a stark, harrowing, but kind of uplifting note of pure propaganda as only Hitchcock could do it.
Probably one of Lorraine Day's best parts.
And I love Lorraine Day because it turns out that she was friends with a young man who lived in her neighborhood named Ray Bradbury, who had a big crush on her when he was a little boy and would hang out around the community theater that she ran in his neighborhood.
Wow.
That's according to a story that Bradbury once told, apparently.
I prefer to think of George Sanders' character as the origin story for his role in the Saint movies instead of him working for British intelligence. But I really love Joel McRae's performance in that because he largely did a lot of Westerns at the time, and he really manages to draw that I am out of place in Europe vibe as this character gets deeper and deeper out of his comfort zone.
Oh, yeah. He's just, so bad at his job, but he's doing his best the whole time, and he won't give up.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good one. So my pick, it's as close to what MGM in 1940 might have called a blockbuster, not in the sense that there are a lot of explosions, although there are a few, but this is a star-studded blockbuster with Clark Gable, Spencer Tracy, Myrna Loy, and Hedy Lamarr. I'm sorry, not Myrna Loy, Claudette Colbert. And it is called Boomtown, and it is the story of two guys who are roughnecks and who want to strike it rich in the oil fields of Texas. It also stars Lionel Barrymore, a couple of other great character actors, and it was not the first movie that Tracy and Gable had made together, and so it was one of these, I know that worked really well last time, so let's make a giant movie and make a bunch of money, which it did. And so Tracy and Gable are best buddies who, they start out having a rivalry, but then they become friends. They rise and fall and rise and fall in ways that are more interesting to watch in the movie than for me to tell you about. They both are interested in Claudette Colbert. I think you can probably guess who wins her. But then Hedy Lamarr comes along to spoil things, and she's bad for Clark Gable, and Spencer Tracy wants to fix it so that Hedy Lamarr doesn't turn Clark Gable's head, and he should go back to Claudette Colbert, to whom he really belongs. And there's a lot of rise and fall for both of the main male lead characters. One minute they're in beautiful suits, and the next minute they're grubby and they have dirty faces. And it's just a lot of fun and nonsense, and it's quite long for a studio era movie, but again, it's a sort of a blockbuster. It's around 2 hours, and it's just fun, and it's escapist, and I am not a particularly big Clark Gable fan, especially in his movies where he's interacting with women and pushing them around. And when he pushes Spencer Tracy around, he gets as good as he gives. And so that's a little less annoying to watch. And he just kind of takes Claudette Colbert for granted rather than being a jerk to her in a way that he is often a jerk in a lot of his movies. So from that perspective, Gable is a little easier to watch because he gets socked in the face a few times when he needs it. So Boomtown from 1940, made by MGM, your big blockbuster of that year's film season.
I have very similar feelings about Clark Gable, and I've never seen this film, and I see it's available on Apple TV, so I will be renting it soon.
Excellent. It's fun. It's escapist, which was the whole point, right? So
totally.
All right, Phil, what's your second pick?
Okay, so we move from fluffy musicals to a different genre of movie I like, especially we find ourselves all trapped in one place, unable to move about freely and at our will. And to me, that is like being trapped on a train. Now, you might think, oh, he's going to talk about Murder on the Orient Express. No, I'm not, because that's outside of the realm of time frame we've been given. The new one's very good. Maybe you want a movie about a mystery on a train that involves less elaborate mustaches. For that, I recommend The Tall Target from 1951.
Oh, good one.
This stars Dick Powell as a New York City police officer who has uncovered a plot to assassinate Abraham Lincoln on the way to his inauguration in 1861. No one believes that this is going to happen. Dick Powell angrily quits the force, but decides to hop on the train anyhow. Unfortunately, has no identification to say who he is, so when he's on the train saying, I'm a New York City police officer, people are all, yeah, right, buddy. So he's got a train full of people who could be trying to kill Abraham Lincoln, and he's got to figure it out between a New York to Washington, D.C. train ride. And it's a very nice, intense drama. It's directed by Anthony Mann. You may know him best as doing a series of Westerns with James Stewart. He's one of my... I think he's a very underrated director. And it's just a very... thrilling movie that's very hard to find. I think you have to buy the physical media. Turner Classic Movies airs it every 6 to 8 months or so, but it's not streaming anywhere. It's a peach of a movie. And if you watch my first movie, Footlight Parade, in which Dick Powell plays this moon-eyed juvenile singer, he's a hard-boiled detective in The Tall Target. He saw some stuff during World War II, apparently, that hardened him as an actor. So it's a very enjoyable motion.
He also makes a great Philip Marlowe in Murder, My Sweet.
Yes, he does.
I'm a big fan of the hard-boiled Dick Powell. I think a double feature with something like Footlight Parade is great, because then you can just see him change and... I argue with film fan friends of mine who think Dick Powell is a lightweight, and I think it's that they haven't seen enough of these later films. I mean, you can kind of see the boyish singer he was, but also I think he's credible in these movies. All right, Jean, what's up? What you got?
I'm going to ruin the mood, but I had, like, when I sat down to brainstorm these things, I did try to pick things that I had seen as a kid. And one movie that made a huge impression on me that used to come on not once a year, but possibly like once a month on the weekends during, syndicated creature feature was The Fly from 1958. And I think it would be a good movie to watch while you're looking for something entertaining. It's so... it's really quite, simple, the story. I've never seen the remake with Jeff Goldblum. So I don't, all I heard was it was gross. So the notion that you could screw up an experiment and end up being half fly, half man really made a big impression on me. And I was definitely, convinced, like, not to go into science. No, not really, but...
That's what you got from The Fly?
Don't go into science. Well, it's pretty funny because, it's this family is very, like, normal, except that the dad has got a teleportation device he's working on down in the basement. But that part doesn't seem to concern anybody until he actually... has this accident. And the whole thing is told in a flashback, and Vincent Price is in it. And I think Vincent Price was probably like one of the first actors, aside from the ones in Wizard of Oz, who I could totally point out and say, that's Vincent Price. Because he was in a lot of these movies that we would just watch out of boredom sitting on the couch on the weekends and our parents apparently doing something else. So I like The Fly. I thought it was a classic back. I could tell it was a classic back then. It is a little scary, obviously, but it is not big time scary again in the context of today.
There is no Cronenbergian body horror in that version of The Fly.
No.
Calling the Cronenberg version gross is an understatement.
Haven't seen it, not planning to, but the notion of a little fly with a human head, it's pretty scary, even if I don't care what state the special effects were back then in 1958.
Help me.
That's a Saturday afternoon classic for me too.
Yeah, it's kind of the scariest little line I've ever heard, and it still gives me shivers. But it's an old movie. I do think it's one that would be fun to watch as a group, if you have a group in your isolation pod, unlike me.
Erica, what you got?
I'm also going for something that's a little bit scary, because sometimes when you're frightened about stuff in the real world, it's helpful to escape into a piece of media that's scary in a completely different way. So my second pick is The Uninvited from 1944. I started this list thinking like of actors almost as much as movies themselves, because I tend to think of classic film loves categorized by who's in them or who directed them, as opposed to genre. So this one I picked specifically for Ray Milland, who was my first classic film leading man love. I just adore him. And The Uninvited is a haunted house film that kind of takes the genre a little more seriously than some of its predecessors, or even some of the ones that followed. It's not really a horror film. It's more a drama that happens to include a love triangle from beyond the grave. It centers around a brother and sister who buy a suspiciously cheap house on a clifftop in Cornwall. And that is another trope that I really love, getting a house for really cheap because it has a spooky past, and then watching the characters discover what that past is. I won't really say any more about the ghost story and the mystery along with that, because it's just kind of fun to watch it and discover it. I will say that I found it spooky and chilling and very satisfying in its conclusion. I taped it off to onto a VHS tape off of American Movie Classics, and I just watched that tape over and over and over again. And I not too long ago got the Criterion Collection Blu-ray of it, and I'm ashamed to say I haven't watched it yet on Blu-ray, so I still need to do that. Maybe that'll happen later tonight. I definitely need to do it soon, because I want to watch it in the dark, but we have already reached the point in Edmonton where the sun stays up uncomfortably late, so it might be a little tricky. So I need to get to it fast. But I definitely, if you're the kind of person who likes to escape real scary stuff into fake scary stuff, The Uninvited is a good choice.
Nathan, what you got?
Okay. So everyone talks about cinematic universes. The Marvel Cinematic Universe got everyone trying to create their own shared universe where characters from different films interact with each other. Fritz Lang invented the cinematic universe, or at least prototyped it, in 1933 with my next pick, also available on Canopy, The Testament of Dr. Mabuse, which is a sequel to two different films. It has the villain from his 1920s film Dr. Mabuse the Gambler, Rudolf Kleinroge, and the hero from another probably better known film of his, M, where Peter Lorre plays a whistling child killer, and Otto Wernicke is the heroic detective in that movie, who returns in this one to tackle an entirely different threat. And this movie is both Fritz Lang's dire warning to Germany that, hey, these Nazi guys taking power, they're not great, and you should beware them, and an absolutely smashing, weird, glorious pulp thriller with tons of cool, exciting sequences. I will admit, I started watching Dr. Mabuse the Gambler and stopped because it's 4 hours long, it's a silent film, and it's, I'm sorry to say, at least as far as I could tell, not a very good silent film. This is a great film. It's a sound film, and from the very first moments, it uses sound incredibly effectively to build tension. But basically, Dr. Mabuse was a master criminal with powers of mesmerism. Think Moriarty with mental powers. But he ended up insane, and as this film opens, he is catatonic in an insane asylum, and yet, even as his body is still, his hand is moving, and he is writing. He's writing out these extensive plans for an empire of crime. And as he does this, it's like his brain is some malevolent radio broadcasting his evil out into the world to infect and possess other people and bend them to his will. And so that's part of the mystery. How is this guy, holed up in an asylum, writing out plans that only he can see, suddenly having those plans carried out in the real world? And so the detective from M gets involved with this. So does a young gangster who's troubled by his conscience and decides to go straight. There are some amazing expressionistic scenes in this movie, including one involving a guy who's been driven insane, showing you the world as he sees it, as a world of fragile, transparent glass furniture. There is one of the fastest and most thrilling car chases ever captured on film up to this point. And there's an amazing sequence in which two people are trapped in a room with a time bomb and decide that the only way they're going to survive it is to flood the room and muffle the explosion. And then the question becomes, will they drown before the bomb goes off? It's just an absolute blast from start to finish. Weird, creepy, uncanny, exciting, and unfortunately highly relevant in this day and age when a single malevolent idea can spread through the ether and radicalize and weaponize otherwise ordinary people.
I've never heard of that one, which I love. Is it French or is it in German? Because I quickly looked at IMDb and I think it said it was in French, and that surprised me.
It's one of those movies where they shot two versions in two different languages, like Todd Browning's Dracula. They shot a French version with one cast and a German version with the other. I would go with the German version. That's the one I've seen. I will say, unfortunately, Otto Wernicke, as much as Fritz Lang hated the Nazis, Otto Wernicke apparently loved them and went on to reprise his role as the detective from this film in a series of pro-Reich films where he hunted down the enemies of Adolf Hitler. So just keep that in mind while you're watching. This guy's a jerk.
Neato. So my pick, and I realize as I was looking at my list, I've stayed in a sort of a very big studio canon, but that's the times we live in, I suppose. So my pick is All This in Heaven 2. It's a Bette Davis movie, and I pick it because it is less Bette Davis-y than a lot of the big movies for which she is known and loved. And many people admire Bette Davis as an actress. I find some of her scenery chewing hard to watch, even though she's in a lot of movies that I enjoy. But All This in Heaven, too, she is basically a fairly meek governess who's governess to Charles Boyer and wife for their children. And Charles Boyer's wife is a terrible, horrible, very bad, no good person. And Charles Boyer is sexy as hell. And he and Bette Davis have some sparks. And the wife causes trouble for that relationship. And you do end up, as the movie goes forward, rooting for the relationship. They've set it up in such a way that there's not really a lot of question in your mind that Charles should stay with his wife and leave Bette Davis alone, even though he tries to do so. And it's a Warner Brothers movie from 1942, and what I really enjoy about it, it's very much about the performances of Boyer and Davis. And Boyer is very Boyer. He's very French in this movie, which is enjoyable just because it's fun, but it's also fun to watch him sweep Bette Davis off her feet because she's a very meek, quiet person. And her accent is affected, but it is, she underplays in a way that, I mean, using the word underplay and Bette Davis in the same sentence may not make sense. That's why I like this movie so much, because it's so unusual. But it's a standard studio Warner Brothers melodrama, but I stand by it and I enjoy it. And so I recommend All This and Heaven too.
My wife and I have two favorite melodramas that we like to watch when we just want to, like, howl along at a movie, and this is one of them. The other one, Barbara O'Neill plays the wife in All This in Heaven 2, and she's in our other favorite, which is The Toy Wife with Louise Rainier. And in that one, she's the good sister who behaves, and Louise Rainier is the frivolous one. And oh, that one is delightful, too. And I should have had that on my list. But All This in Heaven, too, I thoroughly endorse as something to sit down and watch and marvel at all the stuff that keeps happening from beginning to end.
Yeah, it's pretty great. Phil, you have another pick coming. What is it?
Okay. Well, we've gone with musical. We've gone with train movie. Let's go with comedy. Let's go with, for my money, the best comedy ever done. And that is, that even goes for movies of today. It came out 61 years ago. It's Some Like It Hot by Billy Wilder. It skips in under that 1960 limit. And my local cinema has an old movie night on Wednesday nights. They were going to show it this week. They may still will be showing it this week, but I ain't going. So instead, we're going to watch it. It streams free on Amazon Prime. And it's It is fantastic. It holds up remarkably well. There are some movies you watch and you go, well, this was probably funny for its time, or, well, that joke kind of lands with a thud now that we're not horrible people. But Some Like It Hot is just a remarkably prescient movie. It's my daughter's favorite comedy, and I mentioned earlier that she likes Wizard of Oz. She's 9 years old now. She thinks Some Like It Hot is the best comedy ever created because she has good parents. It's terrific. Jack Lemmon gives a magnificent performance. Tony Curtis gives less of a good performance because he has to deal with Marilyn Monroe and her whole meltdown phase. This was when they were having to write the actual line she had to deliver in drawers she had to open so that she could, since she was having a problem remembering things at that point. But it's just great. It's anytime you get a Billy Wilder movie, jump on that. Some Like It Hot.
And watching Tony Curtis make fun of Cary Grant never gets old. Oh, my
absolutely.
Dearest darling.
I'll call that one of my Erica Ensign snipes. I forgot to put it on my list. And I now feel very sniped. Oh, well.
Well, jump in, Jean, because it's your turn. So don't let anybody else snipe you.
I doubt anybody's going to snipe my picks. Another thing, you know, going back to childhood, I've been fascinated by the Titanic. And I have seen the movies. And of course the big movie, but I also watch a lot of interesting documentaries and people arguing on YouTube about what happened when. But recently my local video store, which has now a little viewing room, did a screening of Titanic from 1953. And that was, I had seen it a long time ago, but I hadn't seen it since, you know, late 90s, so since the James Cameron version. And I thought, I'm just going to be a completionist, and, you know. But I was really surprised how well it conveyed a Titanic timeline and the issues that were going on, and included Barbara Stanwyck as the star. So if you like old films, and you probably like Barbara Stanwyck, Clifton Webb as her estranged husband, and Robert Wagner, very young Robert Wagner, who is enamored by their daughter, and Richard Basehart, who is a lost soul, resigned from the priesthood, who is going home back to Boston to lick his wounds from his crisis of faith. So there's a lot of little stories going on between the cast and the different things that, you know, showing actual things that happened on the Titanic. Of course, these are 1953 special effects, not 1997 or whatever. And they, so what you see from the outside of the ship, that doesn't really grab you. But the inside of the ship, it works very well. And it was like mostly pretty authentic. And possibly the best bit was Thelma Ritter, who she used to have like some commercial that was always on when we were kids. I want to say it's like oven cleaner or dishwashing soap. But she was the actress who played essentially the Molly Brown character. And they have a poker game going overnight, like for like 16 hours straight, her and Clifton Webb and a couple of the other that just, I just really, really enjoyed. So I would say if you don't want 3+ hours of Leonardo, and you would like to go over the Titanic story and see it well portrayed, then I recommend Titanic 1953, which comes in a succinct 98 minutes.
I love Thelma Ritter. She was also in Rear Window, which...
Yes,
she's in a lot of great noirs. That is her era, like 1947 or 8 up through 6 or 8. She's great. Mm-hmm. Erica, want to snipe anybody?
I don't know. This is my second pick in a row from 1944, so it seems like that must have been a great year for moody films that make me feel things, because my next pick is Laura, starring Jean Tierney and Dana Andrews. with a delightful hunky leading man performance from Vincent Price before he got all creepy, and a very like just unctuous performance by Clifton Webb, which I adore. And this is also the film that inspired a good bit of David Lynch's Twin Peaks series. It's about a beautiful society girl, Laura, who is played by Jean Tierney, and she's killed. And Dana Andrews is the detective who is tapped to solve the mystery. And there's this huge, like, beautiful portrait of her in her apartment, which he spends a lot of time staring at. And he's, as he learns more and more about her life, he just begins to fall in love with this dead girl, which is both super creeper behavior and also incredibly compelling to watch. And again, this is another one where I'm not sure I want to say too much more about what happens in this film, because some of the fun is just making these stunning discoveries along with Dane Andrews' character. So if you are even remotely into film noir, and also like the heavy longing of doomed romance, but you also enjoy a healthy sprinkling of society backbiting and class conflict, I recommend that you check this one out. It is great. And it's directed by Otto Preminger, who I think was doing an excellent job at this point in his career. It's so moody. The lighting's fantastic. All the reveals are really well executed. I think we may have even talked about this on the Incomparables flagship show. So if you want to know more about it, you can search out whichever episode that was.
Score is also really great.
And, yes. And you've got Vincent Price as the kept man.
Yep.
Oh. Well, I know a little about a lot.
Yeah, I remember I watched that movie once, which was right after Twin Peaks came out. Mm. And, I was clued in by somebody and I said, we got to watch this movie, Laura. But I would like to watch it again. I didn't really end up watching Twin Peaks either.
So. I love Twin Peaks. And I think I watched this movie because of Twin Peaks and then fell in love with it. And it turned out it was also my grandpa's favorite film. So like we had this thing in common that I hadn't even known about until like right before he died. So this movie is very special to me on multiple levels.
And if you get a chance to watch it in a theater, which I have, it's one of those movies that will sometimes come to a film classics series, do so. Not because of any, you know, special effects or anything. It's just a beautiful movie and it's great to watch on a giant screen.
Oh, I'd love to.
All right, Nathan, are you going to be sniping anyone?
Hopefully not. So in our first episode, when we talked about The Setup by Robert Wise, Monty, I believe, mentioned that he loves movies where everyone looks really sweaty all the time. And boy, do I have a movie for Monty. So Akira Kurosawa is one of my favorite filmmakers because he makes pictures that are both simultaneously great films and good movies. And most people know about his samurai films, Seven Samurai, Yojimbo, all that good stuff. But he also made some really great police procedurals. And my favorite of those is a 1949 film called Stray Dog, with his two stalwart leading men, Toshiro Mifune, who, if you've never seen a movie with Toshiro Mifune, imagine like Harrison Ford before Harrison Ford was Harrison Ford, but with Vin Diesel level bass voice. And Takashi Shimura, who was the wise older mentor both here and in Seven Samurai. It is set and filmed right after World War II in American-occupied Tokyo, right as they're rebuilding. So there's an element almost of documentary to it, especially in some of the great second-unit photography by Ishiro Honda, who would go on to direct the original Godzilla. But it is the story of a young cop on the beat, in Tokyo, in this very crowded city in the middle of a sweltering summer heat wave, whose gun is stolen by a pickpocket on a streetcar. And when he tries to chase down the gun, he finds that it has ended up in the hands of a desperate guy who has been drummed out of the army with no place to go and no prospects. And this guy who has his stolen gun is using it to commit ever worsening crimes. And the longer he remains at large, the worse the crimes get, the deadlier they get. So Mifune, with the help of his mentor Shimura, is trying to track this guy down, desperately hunting for him all through this sweltering, sweat-soaked city. Before he kills more people with Mifune's own gun. So Mifune's got that guilt and the desperation of the manhunt. And this might sound like a grim film, but it's actually a very humanist film. There are no bad guys in this film, even the guy who stole Mifune's gun, just desperate people. The film takes time to pause and to, you know, to let you in on the lives of pickpockets and bar girls, And, you know, cops, you know, hanging out in lonely middle of the night police stations. It also takes you through how they would have solved a crime at that time using what were at the time like the most up-to-date modern methods. So you get to go through all the divisions of the police department and look at their fingerprint records and their mugshot books and all kinds of great stuff. The weather's a terrific factor. Kurosawa loved to use the weather as symbolism in his movies. And here you've got the heat wave that builds and builds until it breaks in a torrential rainstorm right as things get really hairy. And ultimately, you get this beautiful, hopeful story about a country with two different paths it could go on. It's come out of this devastating war. It's been defeated and humiliated. But it can try to pull itself up and make something better of itself, or it can descend into cruelty and violence. And the way that's mirrored in the struggle between Mifune and the guy who stole his gun is just beautiful. And for extra fun, this movie is the basis of an episode of Star Wars: The Clone Wars, because they just couldn't stop George Lucas's tradition of ripping off Akira Kurosawa. So it's a terrific film, well worth watching. It's a great picture of what life was like in Tokyo at that time, and just a really exciting cop thriller.
Is that also on Canopy?
Yes, also on Canopy.
Excellent. So my pick, and it comes a little close to Phil's first pick, which is also an early 30s musical. And in my case, I love this one because it's so ridiculous. It is Flying Down to Rio, which is the
Yes!
Ginger Rogers, Fred Astaire, Gene Raymond, Dolores del Rio. And I could tell you the plot, and I'll tell you a little bit of it. But basically, it's all about waiting until the point at which there are dancers on the wings of an airplane that is in flight. So that's the whole point of that movie. But basically, Gene Raymond is an aviator and band leader, as the synopsis says, that is always getting his group fired. He's not very good at his job, but they get a job down in Brazil, and he loves Dolores del Rio, and he and Fred Astaire are buddies. Fred Astaire almost always was one of two sort of hapless buddies in a movie like this, and they stop for songs and dances, and he and Ginger Rogers, of course, have some great numbers, but mostly the ensemble numbers are what make this just wonderful to watch, including the climactic sequence in which, and this is a set piece, it's not just like, oh, all of a sudden this is going to happen and these women are going to be up on the wings of the airplane, but they actually spend a lot of time putting it together and showing how it's going to be put together within the film. So there's some tension about, how, you know, is this thing going to work? Because this is going to be the climactic thing that's going to make their enterprise work out and make them successful. And it's just another one that's really fun to see in a theater if you can. But even if you can't, there's just nothing that defines escapism better than Flying Down to Rio. And I think there are better overall Fred and Ginger movies later on. But this one is just so much fun. I love it.
Yeah, this was their first pairing, I think.
Yes, and, it was.
And their second bananas in this one to Dolores del Rio and
Gene Raymond.
Right,
and that's, yeah, it's kind of fun. And Ginger especially, she comes in, I think, maybe a third of the way through the movie, and she and Fred are clearly a pair, but in terms of performance, not so much in terms of will they or won't they get together, that kind of thing. I think this is the point at which they figured out, hey, these two might have something as a pair, but they're not the stars of the movie, right?
Yet another movie about an aviator who is also a band leader. I mean, haven't we seen enough of those?
I know! It's so, yeah. That trope is just so old. Well, so we have a choice, friends. We can call it a day and leave people with all of these great recommendations, or if you have any, we can do a bonus round.
I can name my extras.
I have many extras too.
Likewise.
Yeah. All right. I can be quick about it.
All right.
I had an extra for each pick that I had just in case they got sniped. But on the fluffy musical front, big broadcast of 1937. If you ever wanted to see your favorite 1930s radio stars on screen, this is the movie. Jack Benny is a producer of a radio show. It's produced by Burns and Allen, and this was when Burns and Allen were still, I think, working on their act, because she's still doing the I'm gonna mishear everything you say and make a joke about that. And George Burns looks like he wants to murder her at several points during the bit, and you're all, I think you need to retool that. And there's some lovely song and dance numbers. It's fun. My train movie would be Berlin Express, directed by I'm gonna get his last name wrong, but Jacques Tourneur. He did Out of the Past was his movie.
Cat People, and, The Leopard Man, mm-hmm. Good
yes.
stuff.
This one is set on a train bound to Berlin, and there's someone who needs to get to a peace conference, and he may have been murdered along the way, and people on the train are suspects or possibly the people who will solve the mystery. And since Erica mentioned Ray Milland and Nathan mentioned Fritz Lang, let's talk about Ministry of Fear from 1944, which brings them together in a lovely, very paranoid pairing about being released from an asylum during World War II and stumbling upon a Nazi plot. Because Fritz Lang, he did not like Nazis at all.
Those are good. Good choices. Jean, have some spares?
I have some spares. They're good spares. I had M on my list, 1931, very great movie from that time. I had The Big Sleep. I thought I was going to get sniped for it, but at the end I was like, well, it's not really a movie that'd be that interesting for kids, as is The Third Man. These are more my favorites than what I would say I'd recommend necessarily. The Apartment, 1960.
Oh, right, so good.
Yes. So definitely people watch The Apartment if you want to see what people, how people live in small spaces in New York City.
And what they do in those small spaces.
And what they do. And then finally, I put King Kong on my list, 1933, again from that pile of movies that we watched when I was little because they were on TV. But that one just scared, you know, the pants off me at the time.
Erica, how about you?
I have a few. In the comfort escapism, I have Top Hat from 1935, which is just the singing, the dancing, Fred and Ginger, the ridiculousness of it. I'm a huge sucker for a mistaken identity story, so I really like that. And I think it's Edward Everett Horton in my favorite of his roles. It just makes me really happy. I would have put Holiday on my list, but since you already covered it, I can't. But I will say to anybody, if you've seen Bringing Up Baby and you really didn't like it, like I didn't, that doesn't necessarily mean that you're not going to like the pairing of Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn, because Holiday's great. But to a lesser extent, My Man Godfrey is another feel-good movie with, you know, it's got a lot to say about class. I will watch William Powell do anything but hear him being a tramp living down the river, going to buttling for a ridiculously family that is also just ridiculous is hilarious. And it's sometimes in a time of crisis, you need a little bit of catharsis. So I put An Affair to Remember from 1957 on my backup list. It is way outside my classic Hollywood happy place, which is like the 30s and early 40s. But Sleepless in Seattle prompted me to check out An Affair to Remember, and it hit me in the feels. It's directed by Leo McCarey, his second time directing this story. And I really enjoy it. But I would also give an honorable mention to Love Affair from 1939, which is the first time Leo McCarey directed that story. It stars Irene Dunne and Charles Boyer. It's black and white as opposed to color, like An Affair to Remember. Honestly, I would love a version that pairs Cary Grant and Irene Dunne, but it has to keep both the songs Wishing from the earlier film and Tomorrowland from the second film. And Marnie Nixon can still do the singing for Irene Dunne just like she did for Deborah Carr. That's what I would love.
And it's funny because Cary Grant and Irene Dunne did make movies together. Just
they
not that
did.
Long.
That's actually my next little mini list. Like, speaking of Leo McCarey, Cary Grant, and Irene Dunne, I would throw My Favorite Wife into the mix for just some screwball comedy about a wife stranded on a desert island for 7 years, declared dead, and then comes back just as her husband has remarried somebody else. And then you get McCary Grant and Dunne in The Awful Truth, which is another delight with a bunch of silliness surrounding a couple who each suspect the other is cheating, and then they decide to divorce. But do they really want to divorce? And like, I could just keep listing Cary Grant movies that I love. His Girl Friday, The Philadelphia Story, The Bachelor and the Bobby Soxer, Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House, and People Will Talk, but like, I should stop. And I had one last one on my list, which I realized I don't know where to find it. But The Best Years of Our Lives from 1946 is a William Wyler film with an all-star cast that deals with what it's like to come home after being in a war, in this case, World War II. And given the world-shaking, world-changing circumstances we are in today, that film really resonates a bit because we are probably all going to have to take some time to figure out what the new normal is after this current crisis passes. And I think The Best Years of Our Lives shows that it's not always easy, but reconnecting with people is always worth it.
It's available on Amazon, apparently.
Oh, good.
So that's, and I see it on TCM a fair bit too.
Yeah, I have it on my PVR because we taped it off of some TV channel. But yeah, it's worth it. If you've got the time, it's like 3+ hours long.
Yeah. Nathan, it's your turn.
I was going to do Rear Window, my absolute all-time favorite Alfred Hitchcock movie, maybe my all-time favorite movie with Jimmy Stewart, Grace Kelly, and the awesome Thelma Ritter. But the Unspooled podcast already beat us to that as an example of strangely relevant films about staying in your house all the time. So instead, I'm going to go back to like some more obscure picks, and I'll do it in chronological order. For movies with an unusual post-World War II setting from 1947, we've got Crossfire, directed by the great noir director Edward Dmytryk, with an all-Robert cast of Robert Young, Robert Mitchum, and Robert Ryan. Is a shadowy murder mystery set in post-war Washington, D.C., when there was a housing shortage because so many people had been crushed into there to help mobilize for the war effort. And it is also, in ways that I can't reveal, a very timely film in a very interesting way, especially for the period. From 1956, we have Seven Men From Now, which could have been an alternate title to Babyface, that Barbara Stanwyck movie we discussed on our previous episode. But this is actually an awesome Western from Bud Bedeker and writer Burt Kennedy, starring Randolph Scott. It's interesting as a Western for two reasons. First, the plot is that the usually morally upstanding Randolph Scott is cold-bloodedly murdering his way through the seven men who killed his wife in a holdup gone wrong. And second is that this movie has a wild card in it, and I love wild card movies. I love Han Solo in Star Wars as much as I do not love Johnny Depp anymore. I really do love Captain Jack Sparrow in the first Pirates of the Caribbean. Characters who come into a conventional narrative with their own agenda and make everything more unpredictable and interesting. This one has Lee Marvin as an outlaw who has some acquaintance with Scott and has his own ulterior motives for either helping or hindering Scott at various points in the plot. By the time the two of them face off at the end, you kind of like and root for both of them, and you do not want to see either one of them get shot, which is unfortunate because one of them does. And finally, to break the rules a little bit, from 1962, we've got another Akira Kurosawa movie, a samurai film called Sanjiro. It's the sequel to the much better known Yojimbo, but where Yojimbo was a straight, like, super dark comedy slash almost apocalyptic film that Sergio Leone wholesale ripped off for A Fistful of Dollars, Sanjiro is a samurai comedy of manners. It's about a bunch of noble, upstanding, totally dumb young samurai who think they've uncovered corruption in their little district. The problem is they've bet on the wrong horse, and the guy that they reported the supposed corruption to is the corrupt one. He's coming to kill them. The only person who can save them from their own stupidity is Toshiro Mifune's grizzled, drunken, flea-bitten samurai who has to constantly roll his eyes and be like, "Ugh, you idiots, you're going to get yourself killed. Let me come along to try and save you." It's a wonderful film. It's surprisingly funny right up until the final harrowing moment when it isn't. And it's a sneakily feminist film because it's a film full of guys who are macho and manly and, with the exception of Mifune, usually rush off and do something incredibly stupid and dangerous, and women who are quietly brave and smart and might initially look like they're frivolous or don't care, but who actually have really clear perspective and really clear priorities in a way that the movie emphasizes. So those are my picks. And Sanjiro is available on Canopy. The other two, unfortunately, are not, but they're available to rent at various other.
Very cool. Thank you so much. I've only seen Crossfire of those three, so I want to check the others out. So my extras are going to be a combination of things I had prepared and things that stuff you guys said reminded me of. And I'm going to start with one of the latter. Speaking of train movies, it's actually on my editorial calendar for Landstar, Towers and Shields, so I'm sort of cheating, but it is a movie called The Narrow Margin. It is a film noir that takes place primarily on a train. Charles McGraw is a cop who is escorting a witness to a crime back to New York and is trying like hell not to get her killed, and it twists and turns in interesting ways. But the narrow margin of the title is a pun because there's a lot of getting past people in train corridors. There's a lot of great noir character actors in it, and it's very claustrophobic because of that whole train metaphor. And even though they do go into coaches into rooms sometimes. A lot of it, really and truly, they are spending time getting past large people in the train corridor. And also, if you haven't heard Charles McGraw speak, he's just got this wonderful, deep, gravelly voice. And he can and has played both villains and cops really well, but it's just a lot of fun to watch. Another one, this is really weird. Maybe weirder now than it was when I first saw it when I was a kid, but it's called King's Row. Stars Ronald Reagan as sort of a good guy. He is a working class guy. Ann Sheridan is in it. Robert Cummings is in it. And they're in this small town, which definitely has a good and bad side of the tracks. And Ronald Reagan is on the bad side of the tracks. And he utters a very famous line, where's the rest of me? Which will make more sense when you see the movie. And the thing about Ronald Reagan is when he was in politics, everybody talked about bedtime for Bonzo as if that was the sort of punchline. But if you watch Ronald Reagan's B-movies, and they absolutely were B-movies from the late 30s up to the mid-40s, I mean, he was just a kind of a ham and egger B-movie star at Warner Brothers and was kind of fun to watch, not because he was either a great actor or a terrible actor, but he really brought a lot of sort of humanity and just, you know, energy to the roles that made him a pleasure to watch. And so we don't do King's Row on the show, but I do have a very surprising movie, a Ronald Reagan movie for us to watch a little bit later on the show. This is the one, I put it on my list because I really wanted to recommend it, but I was surprised to find that it doesn't seem to be streaming anywhere. You can buy a DVD at Warner Archive, and it may be on YouTube every now and again. I know TCM shows it. It's called They Gave Him a Gun from 1937, starring Spencer Tracy and French Hautone. It is a World War I era movie. That's where it begins anyway, and they're war buddies, and they go very different ways after the war. And the premise of the movie is you taught a guy how to shoot a gun, you said go shoot at people, and then you were surprised when he came back from the war and he kept doing that. It's not very well known, which is why I picked it. There are other movies that sort of take that premise of the war broke people, but this is a lesser known movie, and I think, and Tracy as the bad guy is, well, the bad guy is really the wrong way to say it, but as the guy who has the more complicated life because French Hautone goes and becomes a district attorney and so on and has to deal with his friend's life of crime, so to speak. But it's an underrated little film made right about the time when Tracy was winning Oscars and making much better known movies like Libeled Lady and Fury and Boys Town and the like. But They Gave Him a Gun. It sort of slips under the radar a lot. So that's my list.
Cool.
Well, thanks, you guys. This was a lot of fun. And I think we all found way too many movies to put on our queues or our playlists for however long this thing goes on, but good stuff all around. So next time on Lions, Towers, and Shields, we'll be talking about a 1947 movie called Lured. Nathan and I have already chatted about that quite a bit, and I think he's seen it, with Lucille Ball and George Sanders. Ooh, George Sanders.
It's fantastic.
Isn't it great?
I highly recommend you watch it. You can find it free on YouTube.
Yes, and with a nice introduction too. So that'll be the movie that we'll be doing in the next couple of weeks. If you want to join us, feel free. I'm also looking down the road to more classic movies that we can watch, maybe including some of these here. Although I was kind of happy that, except for the ones I mentioned, there weren't any of them that are already on my editorial calendar. So I want to thank you guys for joining me, Phil. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And Jean, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for all the recommendations.
Erica, it was a pleasure.
It was. And now I just have to decide which of these movies to go watch right now.
Right. And Nathan, thanks for bringing all the highbrow art along with the fun stuff.
Thank you very much. You all stay safe and healthy. And that goes for all of you listening out there, too.
All right. We will be back in approximately 2 weeks with another episode of Lions, Towers, and Shields. You can find us on the Incomparable Network along with all these other nice people. Bye for now.